Centenary Stories with Mario Andretti, in association with the Goodwood Revival.
Welcome, everybody, to this special edition of the Motorsport Podcast. This is part of our 100th anniversary series that marks a very significant year in the history of the original racing magazine. To celebrate motorsport hitting the magic ton and its founding as the Brooklands Gazette in the summer of 1924, we'll be bringing you a very special podcast every month throughout 2024. We've invited some gilt-edged motorsport heroes and some longtime friends of the magazine to relive the key moments of their racing lives. I'm your host, Rob Widdows, and today my special guest is Mario Andretti. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Yeah, you're amazing. You're amazing. You never change. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, right. 100 years later.
Yeah, I know. Whatever you're on, man, I want some. Look, before we talk about some of your career, Mario, I want to ask you about Motorsport magazine, because you spent a lot of time in Europe, and I'm thinking that you must remember Dennis Jenkinson.
Oh, indeed.
Do you have any memories of Jenks? Because he was a real hustler, wasn't he? I mean, he was in the up and down the pit lane all the time.
Rob, I first became aware of Dennis Jenkinson in 1955 when I watched the Mille Miglia. Well, yes, of course, when he was riding with Sterling.
Wow.
And I saw that in person at the Futa Pass in Tuscany, and with my brother Aldo. And that was quite a memorable moment, you know, to see that Mercedes just roar by, and his head was bubbling, you know, into the wind. And the first opportunity that I had to talk about it was sometime, I don't remember exactly the moment, might have been, I don't know, even a Brands or something, you know, when I first drove Brands in a sports car before I did in Formula One. But nevertheless, you know, it was really a very welcome meeting with him. And that's how actually I got to chat with Sterling, you know, later on. And he was so surprised that I knew about this. And again, it was interesting moments here for me, but also I think they were themselves very surprised that actually I had seen them, you know, in real time. And so we go way back.
You're the only man I've ever spoken to who actually watched. That's incredible. It's a great story. And of course, rightly or wrongly, I kind of consider you as an Italian racing driver.
Well, Rob, you know, I always say the passport does not change the blood. I mean, I was born and raised in Italy. And again, you know, I am Italian, Italian expatriate into the U.S., I'm grateful for what the U.S. has provided for us as a family, the opportunities and so forth. But, you know, going back to what I appreciate, for instance, in Formula One, I think it's something very special for any driver to win the home Grand Prix. And in 1977, I won the U.S. Grand Prix at the Long Beach. But later on that year, I won the Monza Grand Prix, which is my native. So I won my home Grand Prix and the native Grand Prix. You know, here again, never to be. I was recognized by the Italian government, where they gave me the title of Commendatore. just like Mr. Ferrari obviously has. And that was something very proud from my standpoint. This happened in 2006. And I just wish that my father was still with us. So he could have been, he would have been, I mean, his chest would have been out to here, you know, to witness that. And, but anyway, good stuff in my life. These are moments that were been very precious, of course, as you can imagine.
I can, because winning the Italian Grand Prix at Monza is especially wonderful for you, because I think it was going to watch Ascari at Monza in the early 50s that first fired you up into motor racing, wasn't it?
Indeed. It was actually in 1954 at age 14, which was the year before the Mille Miglia. And Aldo and I, my twin brother, we talked some friends to take us to Monza to see and the Grand Prix firsthand. And of course, here we were, you know, just witnessing Alberto Ascari. It was the one and only, I think, Italian world champion. I guess number two, you know, with a certain degree of pride. But he was, you know, he was one of the early inspiration, you know, for Aldo and myself, you know, to pursue this career, even though at the time I said this a million times, it was the absolute impossible dream, you know, indeed. But we did not allow that to deter, you know, just our ambition and our drive, you know, to continue to pursue this. And then, of course, the dream became a reality. You know, thank you to, you know, many negatives that became positive, so to speak, you know, because at the time we were displaced because of World War II. So the opportunities certainly would not have been there in Italy for us, but it became a reality in the States, because 2 years after we arrived in the States we arrived in 1955, actually, a month after the Mille Miglia, we arrived in June in 1955 in America, and 2 years later, Aldo and I started building a race car, which actually was the beginning of both our careers.
I was going to ask you about emigrating to America, because the early part of your life in Italy, I mean, motor racing is a religion in Italy. I mean, Ferrari is bigger than the Pope, you know, if I'm allowed to say that. And here you are, you're a teenager transported to America. What was your first step onto the first rung? Was it midget car racing?
Yes. Well, no, actually, it was what they call a stock car, which was a modified, you know, street car, which has been was very popular, you know, in many of the tracks, local tracks, which were horse race tracks transformed into for motor racing. They were, you know, dirt tracks, as they called it. Nazareth, the town where I still live today, they had a very popular half a mile dirt track. And you know that we arrived here on a Thursday, and Sunday night we were having just after dinner with my uncle's house. And in the background, Aldo and I, we see this bright lights at the south edge of town. And all of a sudden, a huge roar of engines exploded. And we looked at each other and you know, we just booked on foot. You know, it was about a mile or maybe a mile and a half down. And here we witness looking, peeping through the rails there. And we see these brutal looking stock cars, you know, that... And the last time we saw race cars with the Mille Miglia, and it was in Monza with Formula One. So these things looked sort of weird, but you know, we looked at ourselves, and the first thing that came to mind, I said, you know what, this is doable. We can probably do this ourselves. And 2 years later is when we started building. We obviously assembled some friends, and I always say, you know, you got the geek along the way, the guy that knows everything, which really guided us in the right direction. And we started building. We started building this car for the and actually the objective was to drive, you know, to have it ready by the time we were 21. At the time we were 17, and we figured we got plenty of time to. But the car was finished 2 years later in 1959. We were 19, and you had to be 21 legally to get. To be able to drive professionally in America at the time. And so we befriended someone who was the editor of the local newspaper to do something, fudge the birth date on our license, driver's license. And then we fibbed also. We said that we were telling that we used to race in Italy, Formula Junior, you know, with the Stanguellini. It's a story that followed us, and I could not, you know, get rid of it for years later because and they kept talking about, you know, they come from Italy, and then our family and friends still in Italy says, bugger all, guys. I said, we didn't remember that you were racing when we were here. I said, no, they thought because we raced the Stanguellini in Ancona, you know, because I know that they had they had actually Count Lorani, the you know, the FIA the chief in Italy, you know, he started that, and it was for real. But but anyway, this was one of the stories there that and we began my career actually began in 1959. And it was uninterrupted through, you know, basically my last professional race was 24 Hours of Le Mans in 2000. But going back to your question, that was the start was with a stock car. And actually, I had three of them before. By the time I was 21, though, and we got a midget, and I started driving. I drove a midget, a three-quarter midget, which was indoor racing, and I won the biggest race of the season, 100 lapper in Teaneck, New Jersey, with one of the top midget drivers, Len Duncan, finishes second to me, and that earned me a ride in a full-size midget, you know, the following season, and on. So it was basically, you know, just progressing through the ladder system, if you will, sure. You know, the midget, then I won, you know, with a full size midget. In fact, at Labor Day 1963, I won three feature races in one day, which has never been done before. Mm-hmm. And so that propelled me to the next level. I got a ride then in USAC at the top level, you know, USAC sprint cars, where I was driving against the top drivers, you know, at the circuit, at the top circuit in Indianapolis. And then I won also one of the big races at Salem, Indiana with the A.J. Foyt, Don Branson, McCluskey, all the top drivers there. And I won that, and sort of that piqued some curiosity. And after a fatality in one of the teams, they needed a driver, and I got a test. You know, I'm one of the top three teams in IndyCar racing at the time was the Dean Van Lines team.
Yeah, yeah.
And so things progressed, as you could see. Just moments. I always look back. What if this would have happened? What if that would have happened? And here I got, you know, like my top level sort of promotion, if you will, was due to a fatality. You know, it's unfortunate, but that's the way a lot of things were in those days. And, you know, a seat was open. And actually, the choice was between Roger Penske and myself. And Roger Penske was an active driver at the time. As you know, and then for, he had the first dib on this, you know, but he fortunately had a business meeting that he had to attend. So I was the one, okay, then we'll test Mario. And that's it. I got the job, you know. So, and Roger talks about this often, you know. He says, Mario never thanked me enough for that.
Well, Roger's done okay since then, hasn't he?
Yeah, Roger always does okay. Yes, indeed.
Those dirt tracks, they were dangerous, and as you say, you know, there were horrible accidents. And I read in Motorsport magazine you did an interview with Nigel Roebuck, and you said that Langhorne was the one circuit that you found intimidating. What was it about that place, Mario?
Well, the place claimed in the life of that circuit, you know, that track, it claimed 52 lives.
Whoa!
52 drivers. And actually the year before, I got to drive the champ car, you know, which was a national championship race in 1964. I was there as a spectator, you know, in the infield. I was looking for a ride, and actually there was a fatality there. Bobby Marvin was killed there in turn two, and then I watched him burn to death. And then I got his ride. I got his ride the following weekend in Allentown, Pennsylvania, you know, with a car that was just still charred, you know. So, I mean, and then later, you know, when I got the job in 64, you know, that I told you for the top level, was just before Indianapolis, but the chief and mechanic, actually, the team principal was Clint Brauner. And he was a very astute individual. And he said, you're not ready for Indy. I said, bypass Indy this year, and we'll just do several races, you know, to get you ready for a full go the following season, 65. And he says, well, I'll see you after Langhorne. And Langhorne was the second race after Indianapolis, and which I did Milwaukee with but he didn't want me to drive a Langhorne. And that's when I told Nigel, I said that it's the only race, when I found a ride with somebody else, by the way, you know, I didn't obey him, because he lost his driver, Jimmy Bryan, 2 years earlier at Langhorne, you know, so he didn't want me to drive there. But I found a ride there, and with the Lee Glessner was another, you know, one of the other competitors. And my objective there was to beat the driver that he had, Bob Madhauser, in the Dean Van Line car, which I did, actually. I finished ninth and finished 10th. But you know, going back to what Nigel said, this is the only race that the night before I was really, really apprehensive, only because all the talk about, you know, the danger aspect of it, and I had never driven it before. You know, and the thing that saved me quite a bit, actually, the chief mechanic at the time was a retired, one of the sprint car champions locally, Tommy Hinterschitz. And he was the chief mechanic sort of on the car. And he's the one that gave me some, you know, really good advice about certain areas of the track, you know, how to approach it and so forth, which without that, I think I might have made some really terrible mistakes, because I was all so gung-ho, you know, charged, especially qualifying, you know. So as you could say, you know, these were certain incredible moments in my career. And I remember like yesterday, you know, just because of, you know, because how important it was, you know, and the fact that I appreciate the guidance that I received at the time. If you can, you know, if you can see that. So again, you know, that's the story. But that was a one track that again was really dangerous because you were sideways almost all the time. It was had only one short straightaway, and I mean you were just driving with the throttle basically, and it was one area on turn two, they used to call it. It was very bumpy. It was always getting very rutty, you know, and so you had to power through it. I mean, if you backed off, you know, you just would generally flip. So you had to just grit your teeth and just power through it, you know. And I remember I was the first car, I finished ninth, first car to finish without a power steering. Everybody else, you know, then they had a, you know, power steering, which is a bit different. And my hands were like almost bloody, you know, with the blisters, you know, hanging on tight to the steering wheel. So it was quite memorable.
Tell me how you, right from the word go, you dealt with the danger that was so much a part of motor racing back then, way more than today. Is it just a matter of deciding it won't happen to me or what? How do you deal with that?
Well, I dealt with it by not dealing with it. You know, by, you know, just I did not dwell on that fact. And you almost, you know, had to say to yourself, you know, you're just in the hands of divine providence. I had an uncle priest that, you know, was part of our lives. And I said, he's going to look after me. You're going to look after me, you know, after he passed. And I don't know. I was driven, Rob, by so much passion and love for what I was doing that nothing was going to deter me. And unfortunately, you know, along the way, I lost some of my closest friends, you know, in the sport. And, you know, I hate to even talk about it, but, you know, it's at the beginning of those seasons, especially, you know, when I got to the sprint cars and so forth, we at the driver's meeting, we used to look around and sometimes you wonder, I wonder who's going to be here at the end. We used to lose 4 to 6 drivers every year. One year in 1964 in a sprint car, in 2 races, we lost 2 drivers. We lost 4 drivers in 2 different races. And one was my teammate. And you had to just move on. It was terrible in every possible way because you can never get used to that. I've been accused many times, oh yeah, you have a thick skin, you know. I said, no, I have a soul and I have a heart. And but you had to just sort of just move on from it. You know, I married very young and I had a wonderful lady and my wife that, you know, she married into it. She was not a race fan by any means, but you could see, I felt in some ways, even after I came out of the cockpit, I realized how she suffered inside by not showing it too, because that would have been a deterrent for me, you know, to feel guilty and all that. And I realized how strong of a lady she was, you know, just by hiding all that, you know, those concerns, because we lost friends, you know, the young married, you know, couples that, you know, the principal, you know, like Billy Foster, my best friend, when he died, we were very close to a family. He had 2 kids, young kids like we did. And you know what I mean? It was something that was real. But, you know, there was a period where, unfortunately, that's the sport was could be very cruel, as you know, in every category for that matter. Yeah. You know, if you dwelled on that, there's no way that you could, you know, you could do it. You had to sort of put it aside and thank the good Lord, you know, that you were spared at different times, you know, and that's the only way you can put it.
As you won more and more races, and obviously your goal was the Indy 500, would it be fair to say that your ultimate ambition was always Formula One?
Yes, that's fair to say, you know, because that's where my love for the sport began. Let's face it, all along. And I can tell you this, and I'll repeat what I've said several times, that in 96, first of all, my objective was to win the championship, not just Indy. Indy was, yes, of course, you know, because of the value of the exposure, sure, you know, and everything else. But for me, winning the national championship was the objective. And I was fortunate enough to do that in my very first year in 65, my first full year. But at Indianapolis, that's when I got to meet Colin Chapman and Jim Clark, because, you know, eventually he won the race and I finished third. And at the banquet the following Monday, you know, at the end of the banquet, we were saying our goodbyes. And I said to Colin, I said, Colin, someday I would like to do Formula One. And he said, Mario, whenever you think you're ready, you call me. I will have a car for you. Rob, can you imagine how I felt it? You know, and from there on, it was, the objective was to try to, you know, to do some road racing as much as possible. And as fate would have it, actually, I did quite a bit of lobbying myself, even for the series. But in 65, they had one road race in that, you know, in the IndyCar series, which I won. I won that over AJ Foyt. And so that was, you know, give me a sense of comfort there that we're going in the right direction. But then I enrolled and I expressed a desire to be part of the Ford Le Mans program, right, which they were doing a lot of, obviously, a lot of testing and so forth, which would have meant a lot of miles that I could put under my belt and learn, you know, obviously, the characteristics and of road racing. And I was fortunate enough that one of the drivers there was Bruce McLaren, was part of it, among others. And he and I befriended Bruce, you know, because he was a good guy, but also, you know, for the reasons of being able to just, you know, pick his brain as much as possible, and then watch. He was a very technical driver, very, very useful for me, you know, to observe his style and so forth. And because I think I had the high speed pretty well captured myself, but it was just a technical part of the hairpins and so on and so forth. And so it was very valuable for me, as you could see. And then, and he actually, we won Sebring in 1967 together, you know, with a Mark IV Ford. And then in 68, I felt it's time. And as the end of the Formula One season was approaching, I called Colin. I said, Colin, I would like to do the last two races of the season, Monza and Watkins Glen. And he said, Mario, I will have a car for you.
Wow.
And he set up a test in Monza. It was a week before the race. And I did a test, and I felt so good about how I feel about the Lotus 49. It was just such a sincere race car. And from the experiences that I've had up to that point, which were basically, you know, sports cars, prototypes, and a bit, and the Indy car on the road course was, you know, much heavier and not as responsive because the characteristic of the car, you know, was sure, built different, more versatile. So anyway, we were in Monza. And in fact, I keyed myself, you know, on the time because 2 days before, Ferrari had a test with Chris Amon. And actually, at the end of the test, I was a bit quicker than him. So I figured I'm in the ballpark, you know, and I felt really good about it. But there was a problem potentially here because the Saturday of the Monza race, I had a championship race to be run in India. It was a dirt track race in Indiana. They called the Hoosier 100. It was a a point race for the championship, and I was going for the championship. You know, I was leading the championship at the time. And so I, you know, I worked out the potential, you know, so they would, so there was a 24-hour rule, you know, and IndyCar actually at the time was actually under FIA auspices as well. So, and they had agreed to, to still let me do it. And so I qualified for the Monza. I qualified at the very first practice in the morning, Friday morning. And then I had to catch a plane, come to the States. I raced the Hoosier 100, and then we came back. And I say we because I got a Bobby Unser. I got him a ride with the BRM, with Louis Stanley. Yeah. So we could do some slipstreaming qualifying. So we, you know, it was very important to do that at Monza, especially. And and so he and I both went over and back. And but when we came back, it was about an hour and a half before the race. And my car was on the grid. I was really quickest, you know, the first practice, but it was seventh on the grid still the time. So it was decent time. And there was a protest. So they did not let us start. And so the protest actually was from Ferrari. So anyway, so the first race actually was the I think a weekend later was at the Watkins Glen, which I never seen. And I put the car on pole there, you know, next to Jackie Stewart, you know. So very especially great beginning for me. And that was so wonderful for Colin to provide, you know, the third entry there.
This podcast is brought to you in association with the Goodwood Revival, the only historic motor race meeting to be staged entirely in a period theme. From 2024, the Goodwood Revival will race only on sustainable fuel, a landmark moment for the celebration of iconic cars and fashion, inspiring us all with creative ways to rethink, repair, and rewear. The whole race list has just been released, so head to goodwood.com to find out more and to order early bird tickets. We'll see you there on the 6th to the 8th of September.
We must talk about Ferrari because, well, for obvious reasons. What did it mean to you, Mario? I mean, by the time you got to Ferrari, you'd already achieved an amazing amount. But what did it mean to you to race for him?
Well, you can only imagine that, you know, it's because that's when it all started, you know, at, you know, Ferrari, as you say, was like a religion in Italy, in the '50s, especially. And I grew up with that. And so I first met Mr. Ferrari in Monza when I did the 1,000 Ks in 1969 with Chris Amon as my, co-driver, I couldn't do Formula One full time. In fact, 1970, Colin Chapman offered me a full time ride, and with Lotus, and I couldn't do it. The financial side, I just couldn't do it. I had the contracts here in the States, and the earning power just wasn't there in Formula One, and. And so I was doing it part-time whenever I could. And I was offered in 71 ride Ferrari. And of course, you know, I won South Africa, you know, and after that, he, you know, here again, he offered me full-time, but I couldn't do it. But just to do that, the opportunity to drive for them, but before even 71, I won Sebring with them.
Yes, in the sports car.
Right, yeah. You know, in the sports cars. I had really good fortune with them in prototypes, which again, you know, just gave me the opportunity to meet the man, you know, that was bigger than life as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, when I look back, you know, to be able to have driven for Colin Chapman, you know, Enzo Ferrari, it doesn't get any better than that. It really doesn't, you know. And as you could see that when I, you know, look back at, I count my blessings every day when I look back at those opportunities.
What was your finest moment in a Ferrari, would you say? Sports cars or a Grand Prix car?
Well, the Grand Prix is the ultimate. You know, it's a real thing. Obviously, with Ferrari, we won, three or four races, you know, prototypes and won good races, you know, with great teammates. You know, Jack Eakes was one of them. Yeah. As you know, you can imagine. So, winning, you know, Formula One, that was the ultimate. And then the opportunity to drive a Ferrari is the last Formula One car that I ever drove by substituting Didier Pironi in 1982, and then having the fortune to put her on pole like in Monza. And here, you know, Monza, I was leading, you know, I could have, I dropped, we had a problem with the turbo on the left bank in the last 5-6 laps of the race, and I got overtaken, you know, but I still finished podium. And so you can imagine the satisfaction that I derived from that. But the week before, you know, when Mr. Ferrari asked me to do that, and I had already been out one full season out of Formula One, because my last season full time was with Alfa Romeo in 81. Mm-hmm. But I was asked, you know, to substitute, you know, Didier, for the last two races of the season. And so I asked him, I said, I will need a test, obviously, because I had not driven a turbocharged engine at the time. And that was a big swing to the turbocharged engine with, you know, tremendous power. But, you know, as far as the power curve, it was just very, very, you know, just abrupt and so on. So anyway, he gave me that the weekend before at Monza. No, at Maranello. You know, the track.
At Fiorano.
Fiorano, Maranello, yeah. And so I that day I did 87 laps, and then they put a qualifying mode on the engine, and I set a record that lasted 8 years there at Fiorano. And so I felt really, really good about the car. And then, of course, you know, we put on pole there. So here again, great satisfaction with, you know, with the man being right there, you know, always, you know, he would have his hand in the vest, you know, in his chest. And he had that slight smile on him, you know, that you wanted to see that. You know? So, you know, again, great moments.
I tell you, some of these stories that give me the goosebumps.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I don't know, Mario, there's so much we could talk about, but we haven't got all day. Your relationship with Colin Chapman, you told us a great story about how that started. But it wasn't always, correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't always an easy relationship between the two of you, was it?
Oh, it was. No idea whatsoever. There were some difficulty with other drivers. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an example. At one point, I don't know, forget the actual issue, but with Ronnie Peterson, I mean, he gave him a bollocking like you've never seen. And I was a witness of this. And he said, Mario said, I'm sorry you had to see this. And I said, Colin, if I ever see that, if you ever do that to me, I said, I don't think it will work. I said, I'll pack my bags. Terrible moment in that sense. But I never, ever, ever, ever had a crossword with him. We didn't agree about certain aspects. He didn't like us as drivers to suggest anything technical about the car. And sometimes I would venture there, and I could see that he was disturbed about it, but was never anything you have to say, you know, anything detrimental, you know, something bollocking to me type of thing. So I was fortunate about that. Again, you know, my relationship with him was outstanding for sure.
It's interesting. Yeah. What had Ronnie done wrong?
Just complaining and making some suggestions that Colin didn't like, but there was something there that I don't precisely remember issue, you know, but it really lit up Colin in a very ugly way. Mm. And he just he gave him he was lashing at him like he was a little child. I didn't want to see that. I was surprised, but I had to speak up, you know, myself. You know, I said that because he came to me and said, "I'm sorry you had to see that." I said, "Well, I did see it." I said, and I certainly surprised me in a, you know, not in a positive way.
Sure. What was the sensation like when you first experienced the ground effect in the Lotus? Because I mean, you cut your teeth on dirt tracks, on ovals, IndyCar, and now this is like a space age car compared to that. What was it like the first time?
Well, actually, you know, as a driver, what are you looking for? You're looking for stability, downforce. That's what invites you to go quicker through the corners. That's the whole idea. And that's what we were achieving, you know, with the car design in that respect. And of course, that gives you confidence. And you hope that, you know, your competition doesn't, you know, enjoy that type of thing as much. Not all of it was an advantage, you know, obviously, because there was some other aspects of it, you know, that you were fighting with. You know, the car was not very quick down straightaway, you know, and all that. But you could overcome it, you know, in some other ways. And as a driver, you know, it gives you tremendous confidence when you know that you could corner quicker than your competition, you know. So, that was, you know, the beautiful thing about it.
Yeah. It's interesting because we now have Grand Prix cars with so much downforce that some of the corners aren't corners anymore. And the car doesn't move. It just doesn't move at all. And I don't know about you, but for me, that's taken some of the spectacle out of it.
Well, to some degree, except that, from a driver's standpoint, and look at the G-force that you're experiencing. And still, you know, I mean, you know, even it, like an IndyCar, even on a Novo, you experience up to 6 Gs. And still, you have to be proficient. You have to still be able to react properly to everything. So it's not all that easy. You know, it may look like it's easy, you know, through the flat corner, like you watch Silverstone, for instance, you know. But trust me, you know, it gets your attention easy by any means.
Yeah. Okay, so as everybody knows, everybody remembers, I can still see it like it was yesterday, you and Ronnie leading all those races, and you're the Formula One world champion. You must have had to pinch yourself. I mean, you know, if you think back of all the things we talked about today, and here you are, you made it.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, let's put it this way. Talk about coming full circle, you know. Watching my very first Formula One race in Monza at age 14, and then the dream started then, and then winning the world championship there. The dream come true for sure, because, and what was really premium to me was the fact that I had to clinch the world championship where I saw the very first Formula One race at age 14. Now, can you imagine? You could never design that. I could never dream about that, but that's where it happened. Unfortunately, it was not a happy day. It was a very sad day. I mean, the day was fine because Ronnie was still alive, but we could not celebrate because obviously the next day we didn't have Ronnie anymore. And that was as tragic as it could be, you know, and lost another teammate. And again, you know, so it was a long time before we could actually celebrate that, but it's still, you know, it's with me forever, you know, as you can imagine. And when I look back as to how it all came about, the great fortune to team up with Colin at the right time, and all of those things, you know. So, again, yeah, when you look back, you know, a lot to be thankful for.
You went on racing hard and fast through your 40s and your 50s, winning an IndyCar. What kept you hungry, Mario? What was your motivation at that stage?
Rob, it's pure desire to drive. I mean, I just couldn't let go. I pushed the envelope as far as I possibly could, you know, as you could see into my 50s, almost my mid-50s. And, you know, I won my actually last champ car racing at age 53, you know, and so that kept me somewhat encouraged, if you will. But somewhere along the line, I had to make a decision. It was the hardest decision of my entire life. The thing that what prompted me to say, you know what, I have to say enough, because I wanted to have a good memory of my last times as, you know, as active driver. I didn't want to overstay. I've seen some of my contemporaries, and I will not mention names, but overstay and then not have the best memories of their career. And I think because of that, I have no regrets as to, you know, giving it up, even though my wife knew that I would be a miserable human being to be around for a while. But she even said, I think you had a couple more years in you, you know, but and that's why I did Le Mans, you know, three times after that and all that. But and what kept me going also, you know, when I started driving a two-seater, yeah, car, you know, that it you know, just to have my hand in it. I did a couple times, even, you know, later on, like I was in my 60s, I did tests for Michael. In fact, the one test at Indianapolis, I wound up, you know, just flipping, you know, with it. It was an incident there. As you could see, I just really couldn't never get enough. And my desire, you know, for driving and so forth is still alive, believe it or not. The driving is the only thing that actually always interested me. I never had any ambition, you know, to be a team owner or anything. This is something that my son, I could see, he saw it differently. You know, he actually stepped out of the cockpit and we were still at the very top of his game at 42 years of age. I never had those other ambitions, and I'm certainly proud of him for what he's doing. The fact that, you know, being, you know, having his teams, you could see that he's going to be in the game a long, long time. And that gives me all the reason to enjoy, to be part of the sport, because I still feel that I'm still part of it, you know. And the driving is really what, you know, what meant everything for me. And I can only be so grateful for the fact that I was spared. You know, I've had so many close calls, and yet I only missed two races my entire career because of injuries. You know, you talk about being as the luckiest man alive.
As a measure of how long your career lasted, you were racing Michael by the end of your that must have been I don't know. Tell me, what was it like?
You know, Rob, that was, to me, it was amazing how awesome that was, that to have that opportunity, because we had really some great times together. You know that Michael and I were on podium in an IndyCar race 15 times. And we started first and second 10 times in IndyCar race on the front row. And we finished first and second. And we started on pole, I should say, 10 times. But we finished first and second 5 times.
Amazing, yeah.
And, it's amazing. And as a family, in 1991 and 92, there were 4 of us.
Yeah.
4 of the family, my 3, myself and my 2 yeah. sons and my yeah. nephew, yeah. John, qualified for the Indy 500. Yeah. And in 1993, there was a full podium in Andretti's in Milwaukee. Michael won. My nephew John second. I was third. And I tell you now, in 1986 at the Pocono 500, there was a supporting race there, like a Formula 2, like called Indy Lights.
Yeah.
My son Jeff was on pole for that race. He won that race. Michael was on pole for the 500, and I won the 500. Between the 3 of us, we cleaned house that weekend. So how in the world could you ever hope for something like that to happen as a family? You know what I mean? When I look back, I say, oh, man, have I been blessed?
Yeah.
Yes. Sport has been so, so wonderful to us, and we pay some price, my brother and my my nephew, but my son Jeff, he had to retire, he had tremendous injuries in 1992 at Indy, but overall, though, we can't complain, not by any means.
Absolutely not. No. Just quickly, can we just quickly talk about Michael? Because as you well know, Mario, nothing in Formula One is ever straightforward, to say the least. His team appears to have the support of not only the FIA, but also Liberty Media, the rights holder. It's actually the other teams that are posing a problem here. How confident are you that we will see Andretti in Formula One again? Because there are 3 races now in America. It's a big deal in America right now. And to be honest, the sport needs an American team plus an American driver or two. Do you agree?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, obviously, and I think the fact that we're bringing the largest auto manufacturer in the United States for the very first time in Formula One with General Motors and the Cadillac brand, I think that should be something valuable for Formula One, period. Let's face it, to have 22 cars rather than 20 on the grid, I don't think is a bad thing, especially when the schedule is as ambitious as it is today in Formula One and transferring from continent to continent. And, there's always a chance that some of the teams, obviously, will be overwhelmed and whatever. It's just extra, even insurance. And the FIA, has basically, as a mandate, they allowed 24 cars, not just 22, 24 cars to be, could start a Formula One event. And so I think it's got to be reasonable, for us to be able to enter Formula One by bringing another manufacturer in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not coming there empty handed, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm confident that that the reason will prevail in this situation. I really am. We really have great support from the FIA, you know, looking, because they're looking into the future aspect of it. I mean, all of this is not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen, you know, another year, 2 years down the road. So let's see, let's make sure that, you know, Formula One has a full grid. You know, there are no guarantees. Any other team could say force majeure, okay, we're pulling out. You know what I mean? It's there's not that they, that because they have 10 teams in there, that they have any absolute guarantees that they will be on the grid. Let's face it. That's the fact about any stage, I mean, any discipline in our sport. So, like I said, I hope the reason, proper reason prevails ultimately.
Well, of course, a lot of this is about money. And if it does come down to money, then it's almost certain to be sorted, I would say.
Well, we know what we're facing. You know, we didn't go into this thing blind, you know, so we know what the obligations are. And so that's it. I mean, we're not asking for any special favors, that's for sure.
And you want to be the first to drive the car, don't you?
You better believe it. That's the promise that I have. I said, so it better happen sooner than later, so I can be able to step in the car.
Or more importantly, get out of it.
Or get out of it too, yeah.
Okay. Which, yeah, just a couple of minutes left. What's your take on IndyCar right now? Because we just talked about American drivers in Formula One. There is one at the moment, as you know. But there are the traffic the other way is very busy. A lot of European drivers coming to IndyCar. As far as you're concerned, is this a good thing? Does this give IndyCar a broader appeal? And it appears to be in good health, yeah?
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing, you know, to have a mix like that, you know, with, yeah, and they're welcome in open arms, as you know, in IndyCar. I think IndyCar is at a good place now as far as the talent pool that exists there. And the strength of the teams. I mean, they have some of the races. They have a field, you know, outside of Indianapolis, 33 drive. They have a field of 27 to 28 cars, you know. And so you could see that the team's situation is very solid, and competition, I think, is awesome. It's very good. I mean, it's the quality of the teams is at par in every way. They're no stragglers, so to speak, and that's a good thing for the series. Every race has, you know, a lot of interest in that respect. So again, you know, it's IndyCar had been suffering since the split way back in the 90s, which, you know, it's another story, but I think it's, you know, it's gained a really good popularity, you know, in this country. And and again, there are a lot of some talents there that I know that they have some objectives, you know, and ambitions to potentially, you know, at one point to try to get into Formula One. And, you know, if Mike, with Michael's team, there would be one possibility, because he would feel the Formula Two team in Europe as well, you know, where he could bring some young American talent there and get them all prepared properly, you know, to move up to the top level. And, you know, he's done that. He's created some champions, you know, in the Indy Light series, which is called the Next Series, which is a very good series to prepare his young talents very, very well to step up to the top level. And he plans to do the same thing in Europe. And that's a good thing. That's a great commitment from his part. I think the FIA embraces that, as you can imagine. You know, Rob, motor racing is our life. We have nothing else. That's what that's the way we've fed our families from day one. Yeah. It's that's what we live, that's what we breathe, motor racing. That's it, that's our life. And I want it to be the rest of my life to enjoy going to Formula One, have our own base. Not, you know, it's wonderful when I go there, I'm invited, you know, to some, with some of the other teams, hospitalities, but I want to have my own because that's what I've had all my life, you know, as a driver. And Michael, I want Michael to be able to provide that for me, and that gave me reason to travel the world again.
Great stuff. I like it. And talking of talent and talking of American veterans, your old friend AJ Foyt is in the IndyCar pit lane. How are you two getting on these days? Is that all good now?
It's all good now. Yeah. It's we've had our moments, obviously, you know, in the past, but that's pretty natural. But right now we're best friends, I think. And that's a good, yeah, it's awesome. We every time that we see each other, you know, the first thing he says to me, "Hey man, I can't believe we're still standing." You know, it's right. We have a lot to talk about. And again, he is another one that he dodged many, many bullets along the way, like I did, and still here.
A few bullets between the two of you as well, as far as I remember.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, look. Our magazine, Motorsport, celebrating its 100th birthday. It's been around even longer than you, Mario.
I can't imagine that.
What do you think the secret is? I mean, it's a monthly magazine. It's up against social media, satellite television, you name it. But it's a lovely magazine. It's been part of so many people's lives for so long. What is the secret of staying, you know, upping your game in this business of motor racing?
Well, it's all about, you know, exposing the sport that we love and the fans love so much, you know, with periodically, you know, whether it's a weekly, whether it's a monthly, you know, the fans, I look forward to that, you know, myself, like religion, you know, I just can't wait for the next, the next one comes along. And I'm sure that, you know, thousands and thousands of other fans are the same way. There's nothing like seeing, having the displays, the photos, the story that you can look at over and over again. And I mean, it's everything, you know, that the sport, you know, would not exist without it. There's nothing like having that, you know, that thing in front of you, you know, and yeah, this it's very meaningful, of course.
Look, I can't thank you enough for giving us your time. It's fantastic. As always, it's really great to talk to you.
Well, it's my pleasure, Rob, and happy 100th anniversary.
Centenary Stories with Mario Andretti, in association with the Goodwood Revival.